Much food for thought. Well, here's a one. This is to all the panelists. Since Western civilization got us into this mess, does Western civilization deserve to continue? Can we replace it with a better civilization? To all the panelists.
Yes. I mean, there's no question we can do better, and we need to. But, I mean, Western civilization is obviously a broad concept, and there's many things that we would want to keep. Freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, democratic processes, which are under threat now from many sources, be it NSA spying, be it the flood of money into our politics. The national surveillance state is as frightening as the military-industrial complex, and they do overlap. But I think this notion that the United States has all the answers and it's up to us to save the world, or some people are more honest, to clean up the mess we help create, I think is what undermines our efforts. Internationally, there's a huge mobilization. There's people with amazing ideas, and we need to make that part of our agenda, part of how we think about these things.
Well, I look at what's going on in the world, and what we hear is supposed to be news, and it just seems like propaganda to me anymore. I don't think we have a democratic republic. I think we have an oligarchy. And I think that if we are not selective, I've gotten to where whatever I hear, I'm not sure. I have to think, is that true? Qui bono, who benefits from it? So Western civilization is, I'd rather start off with what do we have right now and how do we fix it? And, Bruce had talked about, we've exported our industrial base overseas and replaced it with military hardware. That's our biggest industrial export. And so people don't, the middle class is gone because there's no good jobs, then there's no tax base. So now the Federal Reserve, the government's creating trillions and trillions of dollars electronically, and they use that to fund all the wars. So let's look at those kind of issues, I think, first. That's what I'd say.
I think the only hope we have is the end of our arrogance, the way we lecture other countries about, you can't have nuclear weapons while we're building new generations and building space technology for war fighting, full spectrum dominance. And this idea of American exceptionalism, that we're essentially better than everyone else and that we know better than everyone else and everyone else should get on their knees and follow us. When we can end that as a kind of a national way of thinking, then maybe there'll be a chance for the planet. And I think all of us have a role and a responsibility in these moments to talk about that and how dysfunctional and dangerous these attitudes are. As evidenced recently by U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, her comments that were printed in the Bild newspaper in Germany when she was having a fit about Angela Merkel's and Hollande's meeting with Putin about ending the Ukrainian civil war that the United States and NATO are really responsible for. And she was just going on and on, apparently, in this meeting with other administration people and Pentagon officials, and just trashing Merkel. And apparently the report is that German intelligence released this information to their own newspapers, and it was printed and it's been now shared across the country, but sadly and unfortunately not in any papers in the United States that I've been aware of. But it's this kind of attitude that is represented at very high levels within our own administration, that anyone else in the world that is trying to stand against our policies of endless war has to be trashed and destroyed, even if it's someone as high as the Chancellor of Germany.
Thank you. The next question is, will the obvious privatization of space serve as negative feedback for its militarization? Since people like Elon Musk and Richard Branson have no interest in that militarization, as opposed to how privatization of the military has encouraged a push toward war. Do you understand that? The people who want to privatize space to be used to make money, are they clashing with the military use of space to create war and destroy the planet?
So far, I haven't seen any of those people, the space privatizers, I haven't seen them questioning any aspects of space militarization. In fact, I've seen the opposite amongst some of them, that in fact they favor it. And again, they largely favor it because they see the need for the creation of a front gate, if you will, a gate between the Earth and the planetary bodies. Who's going to control the gate? Yeah. Who's going to control the pathway off the planet? Because so many different countries now and even private corporations are saying they want to go out and mine the sky. You know, we're told, don't worry about the fact we're running out of resources here on Earth because we can get all we need in space. Magnesium, cobalt, uranium on Mars, helium-3, water on the moon, gold on the asteroids, etc. But who's going to have access to that? Because the UN treaties say that the planetary bodies are the province of all humankind, and no corporation, no individual, no country can own them. That's why they're trying to rewrite space law. And so many of these people are very much in favor of the militarization of space because it would allow them to be the good guys and to be authorized to go out and control the planetary bodies because they're from this country that has the technology to control space. So I see it as a dangerous relationship.
Thank you. Stephen Starr, why have we banned chemical and biological weapons and the like, but not nuclear weapons? Is it the connection to nuclear power?
That's a good question. And I don't really have a definitive answer, but I see that what the deterrence is the policy that all the nuclear weapon states use to base everything they do on. The nuclear arsenals are the cornerstone of what they do. And so I think that they've been less willing to give up nuclear weapons because, but you know, that's why I was trying to talk about in my talk is that they don't seem to perceive that if they, you know, how can you say, well, we have these weapons and they make us safe and it's national security, but a single failure of nuclear deterrence will kill us all. And, but they don't want to talk about that. And it's if you believe deterrence will work perfectly forever, well, you know, who's the eternal optimist? The people that believe deterrence will work perfectly forever or the people like us that want to get rid of nuclear weapons before they get rid of us. So, but I think maybe biological and chemical are seen as less strategic. You know, they're easier to get rid of and still keep the real weapons. You know.
Thanks. Well, I'd like to say that we're dealing with psychological insanity.
Yeah.
Because if we have patients who are suicidal, we hospitalize them, and we're all suicidal. Walking like lemons towards a cliff of nuclear annihilation, practicing psychic numbing. Anyway, someone's asked, please explain launch on warning for those who don't understand. Bruce, do you want to do that? Launch on warning.
What was it you asked?
Please explain launch on warning or hair trigger alert for those who do not understand.
Well, I like to use the term launch-ready nuclear weapons. Because the military's had a big fit in the past about the idea of launch on warning, because they say, no, we're always in control of these weapons. And the idea that we would just launch them on warning is ridiculous. We make the decision when to launch. But, you know, those sorts of decisions, as we heard like earlier in today, you know, artificial intelligence can come in, cyber warfare can come in, where there's things are going so fast that, you know, we might decide it's better to, like, let machines decide what's really important. But the launch on warning, the basic idea of that is that you would launch each side has got nuclear weapons on ballistic missiles that they can launch and can hit their targets in 30 minutes or less and be launched in 15 minutes or less. So there's a time frame there. And both sides have to, the U.S. and the Soviet Union and now Russia are the two countries that maintain this capability. They each have radar, and although we heard that the Russian radar is pretty piecemeal, we have actually satellite systems. But if these systems electronically detect a launch, then the alert is passed up the chain of the command, and if at some point it's decided that it's a valid alert, then the decision is made whether to launch before the weapons come in and hit you. And the idea is that it's always been, well, we will launch before they hit us, and therefore we can take out the other side. And the thing that's been lost in the process is that if the purpose of nuclear weapons is deterrence, that once an attack is actually launched, deterrence has already failed, and there's going to be immense destruction regardless of what happens. And if it's an accidental nuclear war, if you're basing your idea that you're going to launch these weapons strictly on electronic signals and they're false, then your retaliatory launch is actually a preemptive launch. You just started the nuclear war yourself. So it's a very dangerous thing. And the last thing I want to say is that if deterrence is based on the idea of unacceptable retaliation, then it shouldn't be based on the idea that you have to deliver it in 15 minutes. It's just that it's there. And what really has happened is that both it was the Soviet Union and now Russia and the United States have what they call counterforce theory. And this is a preemptive theory. So in the event of a military conflict, for example, if the U.S. gets into a direct military conflict with Russia and Ukraine or NATO, once military conflict begins, then the pressure increases for a preemptive launch because the military on each side is tasked to destroy the other side's nuclear weapons. And so and their military forces and their political leadership and all that. So this it's inherently offensive, and it's not, you know, and that's why the U.S. insists on maintaining like 1,500 warheads, because they have to have all these warheads that they can assign to different targets to carry out counterforce targeting. So it all gets back into launch and warheads. It's kind of a long question, but it's...
Counterforce is hitting the other person's missile silos. So they talk about killing the missiles. This is the Pentagon language. Counter value is hitting cities. And that's just collateral damage.
And so if somebody's launched their missiles, are you going to launch your missiles at empty silos? No, you're going to launch them at cities.
And the other thing is that the U.S. satellites radioed down to Pine Gap in the middle of Australia, which the U.S. rents for one peppercorn per year. And Pine Gap then radios back to Stratcom. So we're right in the middle of it. This is one for Bruce, I think. Agent provocateur makes me wonder if the U.S. is promoting the atrocities of insane Muslims to keep war needed, murderous, or ISIS. And then there's another question on this. A website, usspacecommand.gov, is now shut down. It can be found on the Wayback Machine, but young folks don't know how to search for it. So let's do the agent provocateur.
Could you repeat it, though?
Yeah. Agent provocateur makes me wonder if the U.S. is promoting the atrocities of the Muslims or ISIS to keep war needed. Promoting ISIS, that's the nub of the question.
I think there are many people that are trying to get a handle on the whole ISIS situation. I've been trying to read a lot about it, and I think that, at least for me, it's become clear, as I said during my talk, that I believe that ISIS is essentially a creation of the CIA, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and some other governments. And in my mind, the purpose of it is to continually create destabilization, obviously, in the region, an oil-rich region in the Middle East. I think there's a agenda to redraw some of the national boundaries. We've already seen how Iraq, during the Bush administration, there was talk about balkanizing Iraq, turning it into three separate countries, Sunni, Shia, and Kurd, with the Kurds controlling the northern part of Iraq, a very oil-rich area. And that I think this is essentially what's happened in Iraq. And I think now that policy is being extended into Syria and other places, possibly even Turkey, having some of its territory taken from it in this rewriting of the boundaries of the region, even possibly Iran. So anyway, I think there's a lot to think about and to discuss around this whole issue of a larger goal in the region, redrawing lines, controlling oil for particular purposes and for particular profit centers. So I think that's it's a really important thing. Of course, if you talk about things like that in this country, you're called a conspiracy theorist. And that keeps many people away from outwardly talking about these kind of things. Just like it's difficult for many people in the peace movement to be critical of U.S. policy encircling Russia, because then you're a Putin sympathizer, or, you know, this recycled red baiting that is being used to make people afraid to be critical of U.S. policy towards Russia. So, you know, I think we have to deal with those slings and arrows that come at us in these kind of moments as we try to understand and really have a reflection, a real serious political reflection on what the broader agenda is. But I think we should not be stymied from going to these places because it's necessary.
Thank you. Bill?
I think the idea of the United States creating or supporting ISIS in some kind of direct way, it makes no sense. I think they are, ISIS is an indirect result in some respects of our invasion of Iraq. The people who are the foundation of that organization really didn't exist until they started fighting the U.S. occupation. So I think there's indirect consequences, but I don't think it's quite as neat and simple, because that would imply that the United States government knows what it's doing. And and I think sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And so I don't see them as behind every evil in the world. And I think if we look at it that way, we'll miss some things that would be helpful to us in bringing about change.
Thank you. Next question. What's your take on Ashton Carter, who I think I knew as a young man, and I thought he was in the peace movement. Maybe I've got it wrong. He's the new Secretary of Defense. He was on Selikov's panel on April 98 in Aspen, talking about catastrophic terrorism, elements of a national policy. So your take on Ashton Carter. Maybe, Bill, you could start first.
Well, Carter has a better reputation than he deserves in a number of respects. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about doing a preemptive strike against North Korea. He's suggested that perhaps invading Iran is not a practical thing to do, so he has no moral opposition, but he wonders what that would unleash. He's very tight with industry, although he talks a good game about how there's too many cost overruns and not enough accountability, and of course the taxpayers should be unhappy about this. But it's kind of like basically saying, yeah, we've had problems, but you know, we're going to solve them, and you just sit back and let us take care of it. So in that sense, I think he may be effective in some small regards, but I don't think he's going to change the course of policy, and he's got some significant negative baggage.
Well, I think he's an opportunist, and I see a lot of corruption in our government everywhere, and I'm afraid he may be another example of it. I hope he proves me wrong.
He's also said already that he supports arming the government in Kiev in their constant onslaught against the self-defense forces in eastern Ukraine. So I think that under his leadership of the War Department, we're going to see increased support for Kiev's war against their own citizens along the Russian border.
I'd like to say something about that, too, because it really disturbs me. You know, I've been watching this whole stuff with NATO moving towards Russia. And now what we're basically seeing is a proxy war that the U.S. is fighting against Russia on Russian borders. And there's somehow this idea that we're going to change Russian behavior if we just make things tough enough for them. And how in the hell are we going to do that? NATO's all excited about it, getting 10,000-man force ready when Russia's got 100,000 troops. All that means is that if we get into a shooting war, then somebody's going to either have to back down or somebody's going to use a nuclear weapon. So why can't we think about that? There's no public discussion about this. Once again, these guys don't like to talk about consequences, particularly of nuclear war, so they don't mention nuclear war. They just keep saying, oh, yes, well, we're gonna get the Russians to change their behavior. That's ridiculous. You know, we have to at least think two or three steps ahead to what happens. If the Russians don't change their behavior and somebody in Kiev decides to, you know, bomb Crimea or something, which they seem fully capable of doing at this point, you can tell I find that very upsetting, but I see that as one of the biggest clouds on the horizon right now.
If both U.S. political parties are agreed that nuclear weapons and the military-industrial complex is out of control...
Well, right there, I disagree with the premise. We have bipartisan support right now for arming Kiev. I don't even hear any discussion about it.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not military-industrial complex.
So will that be the answer?
Yeah, I don't see bipartisan.
What about you, Bill?
Well, there have been times in history when a few members can make a real difference, but they need a strong movement to have the courage to do that. You know, we were talking about the jobs issue. The most important job that a politician cares about is their own job. And so if we had a movement significant enough to take some of these people out of power and put people in who would fight for these issues, I think we might see a different Congress. But we're in a very difficult situation at the moment. I think we have to think about things we can do in the short term to stop the bleeding, so to speak, and a vision for the longer term of how we're going to turn this country around on this issue. And I think there's members who understand this who don't have the courage to, you know, stand up and be counted against it in a way that would make a real difference.
Except Bernie Sanders. Not even Elizabeth Warren is talking about it. How do we deal with the fact that the press, which picks its experts, is essentially owned by five major corporations? How do we combat that? Go for it, Bruce.
Just in the last 2 weeks, I've been reading interesting stories about Germany. Apparently, a lot of the media in Germany is, the mainstream media, is crashing. One newspaper had to lay off 200 journalists because there have been a whole series of stories throughout Germany about the complicity between the mainstream media and government policy. Writer for the Frankfurter Zeitung, Frankfurter Allgemein Zeitung, I think it is, he announced in a book that he had been a CIA operative for years, and they would hand him a story, he would put his name on it, it would go into the newspaper. And so I believe this was the paper that had to lay off 200 workers. So anyway, there have been a whole series of abandonment of mainstream media in Germany because of similar type stories. That would be great if this information was available in this country. It's not, unfortunately, and we all know the reason why. Thus, I think all the more important our alternative media is here in this country. And we all have to do everything we can to support alternative media and essentially become the media ourselves. If that means blogging or having public access television shows or whatever it takes, we all need to be doing a lot more of that to help transfer this information that we get in little bits and pieces from other parts of the world to the American people, because without that information, the American people are lost. I don't think the American people are stupid. I think the American people are good-hearted, but I think they're just misled and brainwashed. The minds of the American people have been occupied by the corporate agenda, and it's our job to help decolonize the minds of our fellow citizens.
Well, I still like the idea of think globally and act locally. And I think change can happen. Sometimes it can take a long time, and sometimes it can happen overnight. And with the internet and alternative media, we have the ability to reach out and to talk to people. A lot of the whole stuff that we get is designed to make us feel isolated, you know. I remember in a commercial I heard in Australia, and it started off with one person saying, there's not much I can do, I'm just alone. And more voices joined until the end of the commercial. There was like 1,000 people going, I can change the world. You know, and I've been talking a lot of negative stuff today. Again, part of it's because I'm a little sick, and I apologize for that. But I do think that there's hope. I wouldn't do this if I didn't think. I'd just go fishing. I'd say, well, the heck of it. But I really think we can change things. And I do think, like Bruce says, I think the people that I know in rural Missouri are basically good-hearted people, and they're just trying to make a living and take care of their families. And maybe that's the way people are everywhere. So somehow we got to get through to them. And I don't know. I think we can do it. But everybody has to make the decision to do something about it, not let evil prevail and not do anything.
Bill.
Yeah, well, I think if you have the framework and you're reinforced by independent sources, there's nuggets of information you can pull out of mainstream outlets. But absent a framework and information to compare with, it's very difficult to do that. You know, sometimes there's a brilliant little interesting point in paragraph 32 of an article in the New York Times, but first you have to get to paragraph 32, then you have to have something to contrast it with. And to a lot of, to a large extent, when critical voices are heard, it's more like, it's that one quote, you know, nuclear war to begin, critics disagree. It just doesn't. There's not the right balance. And so I think independent media is probably our best hope of upping the ante here, because otherwise, it's sort of like being politically disarmed. I mean, if you don't have the information to bring to the table, it's hard to win political arguments. It's hard to educate your neighbors. It's hard to be a full citizen of a democratic society.
And we'll leave with one rhetorical question before you all go to lunch. I don't understand for the life of me why the New York Times and the Washington Post are promoting the Ukrainian situation, taking the side of Victoria Nuland and Kagan et al., and actively provoking Russia. I don't understand why they would do that. Are they allied with corporations? I mean, they're New York Times, all the news that's fit to print. So think about that. I do not understand what they're up to.